Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of historian, musician, and journalist Stuart Henderson's recent talk, the first of six lectures in the History Matters lecture series, sponsored by the Toronto Public Library. Henderson's engaging talk, titled Making the Scene in 1960s Yorkville, brings to life the counterculture and dynamism of Yorkville in Toronto in the 1960s. Please check back on ActiveHistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the History Matters lecture series.
So I was just handed for the first time ever information about this forthcoming book of mine. So I have these acts that I can pass out, which I'm just leaving for the first time. It's very exciting. So what I'll do is I'll start them here. What I'm going to do today is try to introduce some of the key themes that I discuss in this book, which, as was mentioned, will be coming out early next year, probably, I think, by March, we're expecting it, and hopefully try to encourage some of you to go pick it up. But also, to echo what Lisa just mentioned, I think that it's really a wonderful, wonderful thing to see so many people here. We get really accustomed to speaking to students and our colleagues. It's rare indeed to be able to share our work with members of the wider community, especially considering that even our books often don't get well read outside of the academy. So this is encouraging. It's really great. On the night of August 23rd, 1967, a throng of some 400 so-called hippies staged a sit-in and then a silent march out of the Yorkville district that had come to be their home, south on Bay Street, and into the heart of downtown Toronto. Led by a visiting American civil rights activist, the protesters marched in snaking file of twos to City Hall and, after being instructed to move along by the police, back north to Queen's Park, where they staged a sit-in until just after midnight. This demonstration, among the few overtly political happenings to emerge from the Yorkville scene, wasn't simply designed to protest the mass arrests which had marked the previous evening in the village, during an anti-traffic demonstration, some of you may remember. The real purpose here was to illustrate to all of their detractors that without them, this village of Yorkville would cease to exist. The performance of absence from the village, not their visible excursion into the greater Toronto cityscape, was the actual point of the exercise. And since about 1963, Yorkville had been synonymous with Toronto's, even Canada's, hip youth culture, their absence from the district on that August night was deeply conspicuous. For the first time in years, it was reported, traffic flowed freely along skinny Yorkville and Cumberland. Their coffee houses sat empty, undercover police were unable to make any significant drugs arrests, which they were unhappy about, and as the Toronto Daily Star noted, pedestrians were allowed to move, quote, unhampered on the sidewalks. At the same time, the neighborhood seemed empty, staid, and colorless. The hippies, read the Star's headline the following morning, had showed it's not Yorkville without them. These identities had become so intertwined in the popular imagination, so fused following years of sustained media exposure of the village and its hip denizens, that the counterculture, or so-called, had redefined the expected map of meaning represented by Yorkville. This little neighborhood was no longer simply associated with counterculture activity. I argue that it had become itself a countercultural activity. As I shall attempt to demonstrate to you today, Yorkville had become Toronto's expected stage for the performances of hip. Set apart, circumscribed by boundaries both arbitrary and yet ultimately significant, Yorkville was known to all as the village in the 60s. It was a zone of difference, a kind of unhinged space where participants could play at alternative identities. Outside of the confines of the district, such apparently countercultural activities as drug use or liberated sexuality, or such alternative aesthetics as long hair and thrift shop fashions, were often read by Torontonians as performances of Yorkville. The space had become the script, the character, and the stage. As such, Yorkville played out for many Canadians, since thousands of young people crossed the country to take part in the scene. and for most Torontonian baby boomers curious enough to check it out, as a means to approach social rebellion, often merely by being someplace. People, in the idiom of 60s youth culture, used to use the expression making the scene to refer to this being someplace, as though it were the people and not the structures that constituted the scenery in any given location. So we made the scene last night around 10 o'clock, Sally made the scene a little while later. You get the idea? But there's a lovely connotation here, perhaps hidden under decades of misuse or disuse, which suggests that these hip folks recognized the power of presence in any particular locus. The same way that an actor on a sparse, even empty stage can seem to make the scene around her seem to respond to her, I like to think that the phrase making the scene can refer to the way that we, as human actors, do something of the same thing to our own surroundings. And so, making the scene in Yorkville was what everyone was up to, and all the time, in that confusing decade, as the place was up for grabs, as it became a battleground over identity, meaning, and truth. In effect, the politicians, so-called hippies and greasers, the bikers, speed freaks, shop owners, media reps, and teeny boppers alike were all active participants, all performers, in the continuous making and remaking of Yorkville throughout the 1960s, as each tried to imbue this stage with his and her own meaning. For the next 40 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about performing Yorkville. First, I'll situate us and offer a brief setup of the scene prior to the ascension of what is typically referred to as the counterculture, baggy and confusing as that term may be. I'll try to demonstrate just how it came about that Yorkville was understood as a limited, definable space in which subversive identity performance was acceptable, even expected, and why this matters. Then I'll offer a few examples of Yorkville as a stage, a literal venue for performance and experimentation. Next, I'll discuss the rise of Yorkville as a kind of hip tourist attraction. And finally, I'll look at the primary badges of village identity, the veritable marks of authentic Yorkville participation, drugs and sex. One of the things I'm not going to do much is engage with the pop music scene, that thrived here in those years. I've left it out of today's discussion mostly, partly because of time constraints, but mostly because it's the most widely celebrated aspect of the scene. And I really wanted to talk about some of the perhaps less well-remembered facets. But, of course, there is time for questions afterwards if you'd like to discuss that stuff. So, by the end of the 1950s, Toronto's bohemian community began to descend upon the district after, this district, I should remind us, after having been driven out of the area around Girard Street when it was torn down to make room for the expanding Toronto General Hospital. At the time, Yorkville played host to a very few clothing shops and restaurants, and the flats above these establishments were often occupied by the proprietors, many of whom were recent immigrants from war-scarred Eastern Europe. Following years of post-war suburbanization projects, which had drawn many Torontonians out of the core of the city, Toronto's newly empty inner-city Victorian houses became home to such European transplants. As such, 1950s Torontonians knew of Yorkville and generally lamented its status as a quote-unquote ethnic ghetto. Alongside their colonization of the area in the late 40s and early 1950s, and late 1950s indeed, came the establishment of distinctly European enterprises. Among these, the coffee house was perhaps the most surprising to Torontonians and certainly the most significant for the future of Yorkville. For many bored Toronto students and artists, perhaps equally enamored of Baudelaire, Kerouac, Sartre, the coffee house suggested a hip hangout unlike any previously known to the city. Now, I did a number of interviews during the process of writing this book, and according to one former villager, a man named Clifford Collier, such tastes of Euro flavor were a revelation. This is what he says. I mean, there were never coffee houses in Toronto, he says. The closest thing we had to anything fancy was Diana Sweets. There were two of them, really tea shops, where ladies went and had sandwiches. That was the closest we had to a coffee house. And then, because of these Europeans coming to Toronto after the war, finally, here were coffee houses. At such establishments, European owners and their regular clientele would mix with curious people from around the city. And it was through this fruitful combination of Euro immigrés, beat youth, aspiring poets, musicians, artists, students from the U of T, all breathing this air of, shall we say, difference, that the Yorkville scene began its development into a youth center extraordinaire. If the word hip, which is among a very few Wolof words that survived the Holocaust of slavery in the United States, if this word, which incidentally, initially in Wolof meant open-eyed, to see, vision. So now, if hip is forged through the alchemy of intermingling peoples, then Yorkville offered Toronto a veritable crucible. Middle-class WASPs, Jews, homosexuals, Italians, and Eastern Europeans were all comprised in the ranks of artists, poets, and musicians flocking to the village by 1962-1963, opening their eyes to the others around them, sharing cultural and social qualities, and aiming to devise new and perhaps less formalized social conventions. Yorkville's coffeehouse scenesters promoted open-eyed awareness and escape from the tyranny of conformity many believed to have enslaved their contemporaries in the suburbs. And so, into the 60s, this coffeehouse scene exploded in Yorkville, offering outdoor patios and tiny stages for the suddenly uber-cool folk musicians and poets who claimed the neighborhood. The coffeehouses were, from very early on, a kind of hip theater. As local artists hung their neo-dadaist work on the walls, as poets stood spontaneously upon their benches and shouted impulsively concocted verse, this may have only happened once, but it gets recounted often. As folk singers sat scribbling their thoughts at tables littered with crumpled papers and cigarette ash, any visitor to the scene by the early 1960s could see that at least part of the allure of the coffeehouse was its spectacle of difference. Indeed, many commentators on the scene in the early 1960s emphasized this point above all others. Yorkville was a symbiosis of beat artistry and European energy. It was an exciting, anomalous, and ultimately amusing experience for any spectator. But there was a self-consciousness to all of this theatricality, too. To illustrate, a cousin to the beat experiments in uniting disparate forms of art into messy harmony, such as the book Naked Lunch, if any of you has ever read, by William Burroughs, neo-theater events called happenings were increasingly popular in the Yorkville of the very early 1960s, often held in local galleries, such as the Isaacs and the Sobek, but just as habitually held in apartments, lofts, coffee houses like the Gaslight or the 71 Club, happenings were designed around neo-dadaist preoccupations with juxtaposition, surrealism, and disorder. Toronto's first documented happening took place in 1959 in Yorkville artist Dennis Burton's studio. Participants, for this is what they were called, because they were not consumers, but collaborators in the very art that they had come to experience, crowded together in cramped rooms, overwhelmed by noise, and by visual stimuli. Toronto author Michael Kirby described a Yorkville happening as, quote, a piece of art that does not focus on an object but on an event. The artist begins with a plan of action in which the public is brought into an active relationship with this art event. The action does not take place in the closed environment of a gallery, but rather in various public places where the artist breaks in suddenly with performance. And so, happenings, designed as they were around this recognition and celebration of the performative aspects of identity, relied upon the participation of the audience. The collaboration involved a kind of agreement, an unspoken desire to play at weird, to engage with others in a highly theatrical manner, to accept that within the parameters of the happening, one's identity was always in flux, at risk, balanced upon contested ground. Gender, race, sexual orientations, age, sanity, all of these and more could be treated as mutable in a happening environment. The attraction for beat-influenced youth, a group who, if anything, were united in their shared fear of the apparent inexorability of liberal capitalism, lay precisely in the wholeness of the attempted refusal of the status quo. In this way, I want to argue, the happening prefigured the lived experience of the Yorkville scene by the mid-60s. Chaotic, rambling, and inconclusive, the village pageant of the 1963 era, or post-1963 period, I should say, was grounded in an appreciation of, if you will, deliberate impulsiveness. The same kind of all the world's a stage sensibility and self-reflexive performativity as those early happenings. However, it would take place on the street rather than in someone's apartment. And it would never fully transcend its reliance upon identity categories predicated on ethnic, gendered, and classist assumptions. As young people poured into the district for concerts, drugs, sex, and excitement in the ensuing years, they would always do so with an eye to the performative aspects of their presence in the scene. But they would rarely freak so freely, if you will, as their counterparts at those early happenings. Now, in many ways, then, the 1960s saw Yorkville emerge as a kind of youth institution. As was the case with other major North American countercultural centers, such as those in San Francisco and New York, and the list goes on, from a trickle of curious youth in the early 60s, there developed a torrential flow. Alongside the Blitz and coffeehouse development from 1960 to 1964, there arose a viable and vibrant folk music scene, an attraction which furthered an influx of young people hip to this beat-approved, suddenly au courant genre. It also paved the way for the emergence in late 1964 of the first rock and roll clubs, an innovation which led to an even greater incursion of participants in the scene. On any given night in 1966, there were no fewer than 18 coffee houses, nightclubs, and hangouts in the village in which someone would have been on stage. And as city councilors struggled to articulate their displeasure in new and inventive ways, at one point even legislating a ban on coffee houses in the district, which failed to pass, and one later suggesting that villagers might be removed and placed in work camps, which was not taken very seriously, thankfully, though it was widely reported in the press, of course, over and over and over again. Yorkville's very existence as a district became the subject of frenzied debate. Its essential character as an appendage of the greater Toronto cityscape was repeatedly evaluated, explored, and decried in city council. As a geographic location, more generally, Yorkville was figuratively cut off. It was recast as a foreign land taken over by teenagers, in the memorable words of Alderman Horace Brown. Or it was recast as an unstable and increasingly immoral zone of decadent self-absorption and vice. As an emerging business district, it was teetering on the precipice, apparently about to fall, its impending economic doom always blamed on the young, rowdy villagers and their inscrutable weirdo rebellion. As a metaphor for Canada's failure to control an increasingly volatile youth culture, Yorkville was potent, vivid, and fearsome. In an era when so many of Canada's institutions were forced to grapple with the huge flood of young people brought on by the baby boom. Remember, no fewer than 7 Canadian universities were built in an effort to accommodate this huge bubble. Here was another, more impromptu institution, a pseudo-college for the disenchanted, the thrill-seeking, the alienated, and the stoned. But it was this perceived foreignness of the Yorkville scene that truly set it apart. For from the moment one place is set apart as separate, from the moment that it is perceived as somehow distinct, it becomes a de facto foreign territory. At the most basic level, the casting of Yorkville as a village, while tied to an historical reality, since Yorkville was, in fact, a village until it was annexed by the city in 1883, served to establish the district as a zone of what I call in my book local foreignness, at once present and removed from the local and the foreign context. Yorkville then came to be understood by participants and observers alike as the expected venue for countercultural experimentation, activity, and identity. It was a place you could enter and exit. It was a space defined by a figurative understanding of the transformative power of the scene. While on the one hand this served as a warning to people to stay away from this perhaps confounding place, of course, on the other hand, it sounded like a pretty awesome and exciting thing to do if you're 17. Throughout the 1960s, Yorkville was caught in an identity conflict between aspirations toward what was called at the time carriage trade sophistication, embraced by many of its merchants, and its rapid development into a party zone for growing ranks of young people. While the city carefully backed the merchants in their quest to rid Yorkville of its accursed crowds of milling youth, media sources awoke to the possibility that Yorkville represented something of a battleground for cultural identity in the baby boom age. Here, it appeared, was the generation gap in illustration. We had young people claiming territory and the establishment uniting in closed-minded opposition. By the end of 1963, Toronto's big three newspapers all began a kind of saturation reportage on the district. This abrupt obsession with framing Yorkville as a seabed for violence, sex, drugs, and music, hardly the kinds of things that young people are likely to want to avoid, was cited by many of my interview subjects as the principal cause for the escalation of their interest in the village. At times celebratory, at times defamatory, but most often plainly ambivalent and conflicted. In the most general sense, these newspapers, along with local television media and national magazines such as Maclean's, Chatelaine, and Weekend, served to advertise the village as, above all else, an important place. And so, many young people, alerted to the perception that Yorkville represented the key stage for a generational conflict, turned to the village as the place to be. By the summer of 64, every evening saw the sidewalks along Yorkville Avenue and Cumberland Street literally packed with people. Cars slid slowly up and down the city blocks, windows down, music blaring. This was known as the Yorkville Crawl. Guitars and bongos played at random, sing-songs were spontaneous, the streets themselves were convulsive with crowds. The phrase traffic flow was merely hopeful. More likely oxymoronic most nights. Indeed, the phenomenon of gridlock on these two short streets is both crucial and difficult to comprehend. Certainly it is, for me, difficult to comprehend. You had chock-a-block from Bay Street to Avenue Road, explained Judy Pocock, one of my interview subjects. And it would take people, what, 2 hours, 3 hours to drive that far, she suggests? But that was their night out. They would sit in their cars, she says, and they'd watch people. She continues, there was all kinds of back and forth performativity. The people in the cars are performing for the people outside the cars, who are performing for the people inside the cars, who are also boys looking for girls, girls looking for boys, people looking for dope. Whatever. So at least some of the participants and observers of the scene in the mid-60s were aware of the theatricality of the Yorkville experience. As Globe and Mail reporter Michael Volpe put it in December of 1965, Yorkville was now definable as a place where, quote, teenagers stand about to see and be seen. Referring to these villagers as Yorkville's entrenched beatnik habitués, which is a lovely bit of writing, Volpe was notably among the first to have recognized the performative dimensions of village identity. His recognition that the village had become a veritable tourist attraction was supported by his observation that throughout 1965, quote, the number of non-Ontario license plates in that nightly bumper-to-bumper parade along Yorkville grew steadily larger. We sit around and watch the tourists go by in their cars, gawking at us and pointing at us, complained a 19-year-old villager in 1965. Like others, he was feeling uncomfortable about this new form of tourism. Another young man told the Globe that he had taken to antagonizing all those voyeurs. Hi, Mr. and Mrs. Tourist, he would begin. I'm a beatnik. Are you here to watch me perform? As Volpe told me in a recent interview, the only way he could frame what he was seeing at the time was through metaphors suggesting theater, performance, and spectacle. I mean, it was just wall-to-wall kids from Avenue Road over to Bay, he explains. It was just a constant parade. You walked down one side, turned around, and walked down the other. It was just sort of a great urban parade area. The central attraction offered by this parade was its celebration, or at least representation, of the diverse strands of village youth culture. For while some of the young people on display were part of what is now being termed the hippie trip, many of them were more identifiably playing the roles of the so-called greaser, the biker, or the weekender. Now, at least three of these four constructed identity categories were both porous and unstable, though they were basically adhered to by most villagers in the period. Now, because to become a biker, one has to actually make a conscious decision to join a club, it seems to me rather different from these other three, quite often externally conferred identity categories. But anyway. Well, the very point of each category was its distinction from the other three. The hippie, the greaser, the weekender, the biker, were meant to tell them apart. Their various expected performances were all united in at least three respects. One, all four of these identity groups were presumed to be led and most effectively embodied by men. And they offered women little beyond sex, drugs, and the threat of violence. Two, each of the categories was comprised of primarily Caucasian, not to say white, necessarily, youth. And three, each of the categories was identifiable both to the insider and to the hip outsider through their aesthetics. One observer referred at the time to the four basic uniforms in Yorkville. The class-based assumptions and allegiances which lie at the heart of these identity categories can't be ignored. For their part, biker clubs, especially the Vagabonds and the Satan's Choice, were virtually always comprised of working-class 20-somethings. And the so-called greasers, curtly identified as the working-class kids by one of my interviewees, were further defined through ethnicity. They had earned their nickname because, in the words of one observer of the scene, quote, "they put grease in their hair and grease in their food." These children of Eastern and Southern European immigrants, most of them, were working class youth in a scene typically defined by its middle class, apparently hippie, cohort. Indeed, although the generally middle class hippies and suburban weekenders, which literally weekend hippies, were no more than components of this diverse scene, they were always the primary focus of any external interest in Yorkville. While the bikers and so-called greasers caused observers disgust and anxiety, their lengthy articles and speeches and sermons on Yorkville virtually always centered on what they saw as the real issue, the middle-class manifestations of hip identity. They usually offered variations on a simple narrative built around the idea of Yorkville as a transformative space. The story went like this. A nice kid from a nice family in the suburbs, middle class, solidly, you know, good members of the community, they go to church, they do all the right things, goes down to Yorkville and gets ruined. And in this narrative, drugs, and for girls, sex, were the primary causes of this ruination. Now, though the language was often absurdly over-cautious or even Victorian with respect to the dangers of experimentation with drugs and sex, shocked observers of the scene certainly did have a point. These two activities were absolutely central to the village experience for many, many people. Whereas drug use in pre-1965 Yorkville was more of an aspect of pseudo-bohemianism, later manifestations of Yorkville youth culture had begun to take on drug use as the central, almost obligatory, articulation of village identity. In short, by 1966 to 1967, drug use, Yorkville, and the counterculture were all intertwined in the Toronto imagination. While the Yorkville youth culture would come to recognize the badge of countercultural identity as experience with marijuana and LSD, it was well understood by outsiders that to participate in the Yorkville was to be high on drugs. In other words, it was widely held that you could not do Yorkville without being high. It was as if the location, the activity, and the actor were fused together through performance, expression, and identity. By the mid-60s, young people, especially those so-called weekenders, who were demographically the youngest set, would commonly arrive in Yorkville of a Friday night, buy some kind of drug, and spend the weekend smoking, eating, or dropping it. But interestingly, a number of my interviewees mentioned that it was also common practice for them to take home whatever dope was left over on Sunday night and save it for next weekend, because it didn't seem to make sense to get high outside of Yorkville. In the village, the principal drugs in circulation were marijuana, amphetamines, and LSD, especially in the first half of the 1960s. However, by the winter of 67 to 68, the Addiction Research Foundation reported that beside these ubiquitous drugs, quote, the substances in regular use in Yorkville for kicks or mood changes include Frost, which is something that I do not know what it is, but I suspect it's nitrous oxide, cough syrups, asthma preparations, codeine pills, morning glory seeds, STP, airplane glue, nose drops, stramonium, opium, DMT, nail polish remover, cigarettes, and of course, alcohol. Further, the Addiction Research Foundation complained that, quote, there appear to be almost no norms of moderation established for the control of drug experiences. There is no concept of excess, abuse, or overindulgence with regard to these non-narcotic drugs. As their undercover field worker, because of course they had sent in someone to pose as a villager in order to gather this information, as this undercover field worker learned after his identity was nearly revealed, quote, one could not maintain status as a villager without frequently using drugs. In fact, in order to maintain his anonymity and to ensure the trust and respect of his subjects, the field worker had begun collecting drugs and giving them away to people in exchange for interviews. Well, it is no doubt significant that the field worker literally dressed in costume, his words, as a hippie to properly infiltrate the scene. Ultimately, it was his inexperience with drugs that nearly exposed the inauthenticity of his act, and it was not actually his affected garb. Drug use, then, was such a primary activity in the area that to perform village identity was impossible without at least some connection to the drug scene. Meanwhile, a growing obsession with Yorkville as a zone of hedonistic, liberated sexuality overcame many observers and participants alike, as they began to equate the village with sex nearly as readily as with drug use. For many villagers, to be sure, adopting the ethic of liberated sexuality constituted a certain refusal of middle-class values, a rejection of the sober sexual politics of their parents' generation. Much as they did with drugs and rock and roll music, hip youth used sex to create a countercultural identity. And yet, the uses of sex to this end were often undeniably exploitative, even as they were couched in the rhetoric of liberation. Many young people, and most of them young women, found that too often what masqueraded as a liberated sexuality was something rather less beautiful. It was sex for money, for drugs, for food, for a place to sleep. It was a pernicious STD. It was a smooth-talking stranger who brought you home to his gang of friends for a lopsided orgy. It was yet another village pregnancy, a highly unwanted, terminally uncool situation. While it was by no means always like this, indeed, many women found sex in the village to be a healthy, attractive, and ultimately safe and satisfying experience, some, it must be said, did not. In some ways, the problem was one of patriarchal assumptions about power. Too often, writing and observances from the period, both generated from within and without, men were cast as the active drug users, the active rock and rollers. Women were merely there, present, passive recipients of a hip male rebellion. Just as the terms youth, tough, and beatnik were code for teenage boy in the first half of the decade, to have been a hippie, a greaser, or a biker by 1966 and beyond was to be male. A hip female was most often dubbed a girl, and she was usually perceived to be in some genuine danger, sexual or otherwise. Even the term youth was male first, female second. All reportage from the period seems to demonstrate that youths were hanging out with girls, that hippies were hanging out with girl hippies. Weekenders were hanging out with teeny boppers. Many articles on the scene then drew a clear distinction between the stakes for men and for women. Whereas young men were coming to the village, becoming hippies, doing drugs, and slipping from their middle-class perches, or at least this was the narrative, young women were coming to Yorkville and losing their virginity. Or as Deputy Chief of Police Bernard Simmons put it in late 1967, the real evil of Yorkville is what is happening to these young girls. They come to the village as good kids, mixed up perhaps, many from fine homes, and these beatniks grab them, and within 2 days, they are ruined. Regardless, or perhaps in spite of such admonitions, As non-villagers became aware that sexuality was an aspect of the countercultural arsenal, it, like drugs and rock and roll, became part of the draw. To put it mildly, Yorkville was known as a spot where not only could you find a great rock band, maybe find some drugs, but you also had a fair chance of meeting a very casual sexual partner. And so, awash in promises of rock and roll music, good dope, and plentiful sex, by 67, Yorkville's status as a hip playground attracted thousands of curious young people. Young and old, in fact, straight and bendy, from all over Toronto and beyond. By the late 60s, the village was inundated by a diversity of people, many of whom had come, however, not to be part of the scene, but simply to watch, as though it were a human zoo. A hippie zoo, even. When, during a media-fueled but ultimately baseless hepatitis scare in the summer of 1968, shops, coffee houses, and rock and roll clubs were shuttered by order of the city, concerned as they were about something the media was unhelpfully referring to as hippie hepatitis, Yorkville finally began to lose its cachet. More and more, the idea of Yorkville as the expected zone for the performance of counterculture was fading into the middle distance, as what had been seen as radical and subversive only a few years before was becoming commonplace. Yorkville became ever more normalized, and the idea of the villager appeared to shift almost overnight. Key figures in the Yorkville scene, such as David DePoe, who was a leader of the Diggers, an anarchist humanitarian outfit, Mike Wage, who was a volunteer at the church, the hip hangout on Avenue Road, and Murray McLaughlin, the village folk singer, all complained publicly that these new villagers were performing an inauthentic version of hipness. "The true hippies are gone," was DePoe's terse assessment in 1969, a reflection of what many were coming to realize. Whatever had been authentic and organic about the village scene in the mid-60s seemed to have been diluted by the influx of so many tourists by a decade's end. So, to wrap up. In societies dominated by modern conditions of production, this is my really academic quote, I apologize. In societies dominated by modern conditions of production, argued Guy Debord in a landmark 1967 text, life is presented as an immense accumulation of spectacles. Everything that was once directly lived has moved away into representation. If we follow Debord's argument, Yorkville's hip theater stands as a significant example of the limitations of cultural experimentation in the society of the spectacle. Now, one hesitates to view the hip village in terms of a winners and losers framework, because that's just reductionist and kind of goofy, frankly. There still is no question that it was the hip embrace of spectacle and performance which allowed masses of people to engage with the scene, while simultaneously setting up the scene as a site of limited political potential. In general, the New Left distanced itself from the scene. So generally did feminists, black activists, student activists, and other political groups. All were in some respect critical of the ephemerality of the hip performance as they saw it, and the sense that whatever these performances represented, they had no meaningful potential for positive political change. In Yorkville, throughout the 60s, a series of competing heuristics saw the village become an interpretive battleground. These ways of seeing the village were based, all of them, on politically motivated concerns. Was Yorkville to be an oasis of beat youth or an enclave of carriage trade sophistication? Was it to be the haven for young people or, as the city council plainly decided in 1968's plan for Yorkville, a rejuvenated shopping center? In the end, one side won the ground. Yorkville by 1971 was a decidedly upmarket district with few connections to the hip scene. Because Yorkville was throughout the 60s conflated with hip Yorkville, with hip Toronto, with youth energies and identities, because performing Yorkville was understood to be the same as performing hip, because Yorkville seemed to represent the whole scene, a synecdoche for the otherwise diffusive hip youth culture, that is to say, a metaphor for the entire culture. Because of all of this, when much of Yorkville was annihilated by developers and municipal pressure, It was possible, at least metaphorically, to perceive this as the annihilation of the counterculture. "The hippies are gone," read a telling headline in the Toronto Telegram in mid-1969. It didn't help that most of the villagers who would otherwise have been spending their days and nights very visibly on Yorkville and Cumberland had found a new, entirely invisible home down the street at Rochdale College. Off the streets, effectively erased from the visage of the city, Rochdale's hip scene operated as a mostly self-contained, even to a point self-reflexive unit. Throughout the 60s, the village may have been metaphorically cut off from Toronto, you know, tied to this map of meaning which treated it as an island of difference within the wider city. But Rochdale actually was cut off in important ways. Its inhabitants cloistered themselves. Some, perhaps this is a lie, rarely ever left the building. Under a kind of self-imposed exile from the wider community, Rochdale in some ways represents the failure of the integrationist politics in the hip world. But, in a very real sense, it was the end of the Yorkville scene. From the get-go, ex-villagers streamed into Rochdale, and they brought with them all of the problems that would keep Rochdale from ever really achieving any of the goals its originators had set for it. By 1969, as its founders gave up on their creation in despair, though Rochdale would continue on until 75, Rochdale was already a densely populated place. Most of these people, the detritus of the busted village scene. These were the homeless kids, runaways, the needle freaks. There were also the poets and radicals, the hippies, bikers, greasers, and weekenders. But the weekenders now at Rochdale were dubbed crashers. Rochdale became Toronto's new epicenter of hip, improving on Yorkville in a variety of ways. No cops, no parents, no politicians, no snow, no money, fewer hassles. Okay, different hassles. And recreating much of what the village had to offer. Plentiful drugs, abundant sex, like-minded young people, a sense of community and spontaneity. Rochdale was like the push broom that swept through the village in the late 60s, carrying most everyone away. But whereas Yorkville had represented, quote, "a cancer that is spreading through Metro," in the famous words of MPP George Benn, Rochdale was self-contained and as such non-threatening. As hip Yorkville entered its final desultory period into 1969 and 1970, Rochdale emerged as the new local site for this great pursuit of living otherwise. The city of Toronto, however accidentally, had managed to find a way to rid its streets of its most public stage for hip identity, experimentation, and performance. They had remade the scene. Thanks.
You've just listened to Stuart Henderson's talk titled Making the Scene in 1960s Yorkville, the first of six lectures in the History Matters series sponsored by the Toronto Public Library. Please check back on activehistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the History Matters lecture series.